Welcome to the Jeffers Brief, only on Contra Radio Network.
All right. Welcome to another episode of the Jeffers Brief. I'm your host, John Jeffers, here at the Contra Radio Network, also on KYAH 540 AM out of Delta, Utah, Utah's Talk Authority. Welcome to the show. We have another, what is this? Okay, yeah, we'll do that. There you go. My virtual studio audience. You know, today we've got some stuff we want to talk about. You know, gosh, so many things. I got an interesting post from a longtime listener down in Texas. He said, oh, CRN's gone political. I suppose I should weigh in. And my response to him was, you know, Contra Radio Network is not just for preppers. It's for patriots as well. And so, I don't know if you've noticed, but in the, say, the last month or so, I've started to integrate more of the prepper items along with the patriot items, which is, you know, has to do with being political. But a lot of the stuff, I don't think that I can overlook it just because. Particularly the attempted coup. Now, it would seem to me that in ancient Rome, if you were caught in a trying to overthrow the emperor, there wouldn't be an investigation. There wouldn't be anything. All coup conspirators would be put to death. It's true. Are you saying we should just put them all to death? Maybe not to death. How about long federal prison terms in Leavenworth, where they are to sit there and make little rocks out of big rocks? This is just my opinion. Let them serve as an example to all. All right. Some of you, apparently, the story is starting to break. I saw it last night. And perhaps you've seen it. And perhaps you've heard about the so-called red flag laws. You know, they don't target the criminal. They're targeting law-abiding gun owners. This is important, especially if you're a prepper. Because as a prepper, more often, I would say 99% of the time of you out there who are preppers have a firearm. It may not be a rifle, this may be a simple semi-automatic pistol or even a revolver. However, Antifa, whom I detest, have sit there and they have used the red flag laws. I believe it is in the state of Washington. I'm trying to locate the information in Washington State. No, I'm sorry, Oregon. And they called it on their political opponents. They threw the red flag on their political opponents. This is what we can expect from red flag laws. Again, great idea. Unfortunately, as the longer you've been alive, the more you can attest to this, and that is the path to hell is paved with good intentions. And it is so true of so many leftist ideas. You know, on surface, they look great, but you give it a little bit, just a little bit more thought, a little bit more looking into it, and you start to realize, no, because with socialism, you can vote your way into socialism, but you have to shoot your way out. Think about that for a moment. So I did some looking up, and the American Spectator, Mark Smith, and he actually addressed the red flag laws, how they're going to be the lethal leftist weapons, and we've just already seen it yesterday. So a real gunfight is underway in America today, and it doesn't target criminals or gang members who possess guns. It's a fight waged against law-abiding citizens and their right to own and use firearms of their choice for self-defense or other lawful purposes. Red flag laws are a classic example of how the anti-gun lobby wants to choke off the Second Amendment rights of law-abiding citizens. These laws slowly erode our rights by creating a judicial mechanism that allows law enforcement to come to a gun owner's home and seize lawfully owned firearms based on mere accusations about the gun owner's mental health or his potential dangerous future behavior. Can you say Minority Report? It's fairly obvious that violent convicted felons and people who are seriously mentally ill with violent tendencies should never have firearms. I think we can all agree with that. Yet people like this are turned loose by prisons and jails every day to wreak havoc on our streets, with or without guns. In spite of this reality, progressives want the law-abiding citizens disarmed. They want ordinary Americans to depend on government to protect our lives. That's the same government that can't keep Jeffrey Epstein alive while locked up in a 10-by-10-foot cell. Red flag laws attack the liberties of American gun owners one person at a time. Not a fan of your firearm, owning ex-spouse, sister-in-law, or neighbor? All you need to do is fabricate an accusation that she is a danger to herself or others. All it would take is one person who holds a grudge and is willing to make a phone call articulating a credible story. Red flag laws empower agenda driven psychologists, police, politicians, and attorneys to move quickly against gun owners with court orders to seize firearms with virtually no due process for the accused. If such laws keep getting passed, gun confiscation could happen to anyone. Red flag laws place law-abiding gun owners at the mercy of social justice do-gooders and timid judges who will rubber stamp confiscation orders simply because an accuser's allegations meet the straight face test. Don't kid yourself with rhetoric about and delusions of due process. All the presumptions built into the court system will weigh against a gun owner in favor of confiscation. Many proposed red flag laws view having an interest in firearms or having recently purchased firearms as a risk factor in favor of taking away firearms. Any gun owner caught in the net of red flag law will have costly and lengthy legal woes ahead of them. They will likely have to hire a lawyer, take time from work to attend expensive and time-consuming court hearings, and fight to regain their rights and property. They will not be able to recover their costs and legal fees, even if they manage to win in court and recover their guns, whatever condition they are in. Their name will be listed in government registries as someone who was credibly reported as a threat. They will be forever in the system. If you are poor and unable to afford an attorney, then good luck trying to win in court. Let's back it up here. And I want you to listen to this. Even if they manage to win in court and recover their guns, whatever condition they are in, they could turn your firearms and make them inoperable. There is nothing that says they have to, There's nothing that says they have to return the firearm in the condition in which they confiscated it. Think about that. So don't think the legal system could be abused for political reasons. Then perhaps you should be introduced to Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller. Who's to stop an anti-gun activist from lying about you using the authority of a red flag law? They call the NRA a terrorist organization. So doesn't that make members of the NRA aiders and abettors to a terrorist organization in the eyes of many people who hate guns? And if you're allegedly aiding and abetting a terrorist organization, wouldn't that be grounds for calling the cops under a red flag law? Red flag laws will set a precedent for allowing government to micromanage the right to keep and bear arms and convert this constitutional right into a mere privilege granted by the government bureaucrats to only a select few. These proposed laws tap into legitimate fears. Nobody wants to face a maniac wielding a gun, or any weapon for that matter. But gun grabbers aren't interested in giving law enforcement agencies the resources they make or they need to take guns from convicted felons. Nor will the left likely endorse calls for greater use of civil commitment for the mentally ill. And activists certainly do not want to allow ordinary Americans, who are the real first responders to any violent attack, to be armed to fight back against violent, evil thugs. No, those railing against gun ownership wants to disarm all of society, but most particularly conservative red state Americans. Red flag laws are their latest effort to do just that, one gun owner at a time. Mark Smith is correct. He is correct in his assessment. Think about this. Oh, hey, did you hear about AOC, the ass of Congress, 29-year-old bartender, lectures a Navy SEAL on how to handle firearms? Communist Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, some call her AOC because it's cool and hip, I call her the ass of Congress. On Wednesday, lectured Congressman Dan Crenshaw, Republican of Texas. Perhaps you've seen him. He's the veteran who wears an eye patch. He actually lost it serving his country. Anyway, she lectures him on how to handle firearms. Now, Crenshaw served as a Navy SEAL for 10 years, including five tours of duty in the Middle East and South Korea. Crenshaw lost his right eye in 2012 after an IED detonated near him in Afghanistan. But the 29-year-old bartender knows more about firearms and the Second Amendment than Crenshaw. It started out like this. Crenshaw defended the Second Amendment on Tuesday after yet another story about an armed woman who defended herself from five men tried to rob her. Crenshaw tweeted out, "Situations like this story are why we protect the Second Amendment." Side note, with universal background checks, I wouldn't be able to let my friends borrow my handgun when they travel alone like this. We should make felons out of people just for defending themselves. That's what he says. However, AOC dropped in as if she's the expert and lectured Crenshaw. She tweets back to him, "You are a member of Congress. Why are you lending guns to people unsupervised who can't pass a basic background check? The people you're giving a gun to have likely abused their spouse or have a violent criminal record, and you may not know it. Why on earth would you do that?" Well, Crenshaw did respond to the ass of Congress on Wednesday afternoon and crushed her. He says, "Just so I'm clear, you think my friends are domestic abusers and criminals? Seriously, that's your argument? That they can't pass a background check? Wrong. People lend guns to friends, especially if they don't own a gun, for self-defense and hunting purposes. This is America outside of New York City." There you go. Now, you probably have not even seen this little bit of article here. Dinesh D'Souza. I like Dinesh D'Souza. He's a man who sticks by his guns. Literally sticks by his guns, won't back down. Hey, by the way, if those of you that are watching the video, you like the hat? You can get the same hat, different colors, though, if you wish. Just go to the Contra Radio Network, the CRN store. Let's look for it at queensborough.com. You'll find our store there. You can get all kinds of shorts, shirts, hats, winter hats, whatever. You can get them there. Plus, every time you buy something, it helps support Contra Radio Network and all the shows we have here. Which, by the way, if you haven't listened to some of the other shows we have on the Contra Radio Network, we've got the Conservative Underground with Don Lowry. You might want to listen to him. We got the prepper guy himself, Mark Boyle. Mark and Don live in free America. That'd be Arizona. You might want to check out their stuff. And we also got Wynn Parkinson out on the East Coast in the Carolinas. He's talking about, well, all kinds of interesting things for homesteaders to know and to look at. Well, it's true. It is. It really is. So anyways. Anyways, I was saying, where was he? Was he on, he was on MRC. I think it was on Laura Ingraham's show. And what he's saying is this. Gun confiscators are coming out of the closet in an all-out assault on the Second Amendment. Listen to Dinesh. Judge for yourself.
Well, I think that this vindicates kind of what the NRA has been warning from the outset. At first, for many years, I thought that the NRA was kind of using, you may call it the slippery slope argument, which was essentially that once you start outlawing one type of weapon, you will then slowly proceed to outlawing the next type, and eventually it becomes a kind of comprehensive confiscation. But I think what's interesting here is this is not even a slippery slope. It now appears like there's a whole group of people that from the outset want a comprehensive ban, and these mass shootings are making them come out of the closet, you may say rhetorically, and be more and more frank and candid about what their real agenda is. It never was a kind of targeted or narrowly tailored law. It's ultimately an all-out assault on the Second Amendment. And let's remember too, Laura, that the Second Amendment is no less important than the First Amendment or the Fourth Amendment, so we should very jealously guard against these constitutional rights being stripped away based upon some sort of pretext. My rights, if you're going to abuse your rights, the solution is not to take away my rights.
There you go. Now, something you need to understand, and you probably do. Most of you are patriots that listen to this show. Some of you are what we say on the middle of the fence. However, know this. It's the Second Amendment that ensures that the rest of the amendments are not taken away. Think about that. Now, I remember as a kid growing up, and I heard the slippery slope. I was in high school, probably about 1981, 1982. And that's when I first heard about this. And I thought, what the hell is the NRA talking about? And just so you know, at that time, both my parents were Democrat libs. Well, it's funny how the worm turns, isn't it? Because I'll tell you, my father now is an absolute diehard conservative. My mother is a recovering liberal and is starting to embrace conservatism as well as embrace the president. She wasn't against him. She just wasn't sure what to make of him. And I've helped her along the way. So, but at the time, I'm thinking, slippery slope? What the hell is that? And so, you know, somebody told me about it. I'm thinking, well, that's nuts. Who would do that? Here we are, you know, 35, 40 years down the road, and that's exactly what they're trying to do. You know, you got Democrats demanding, you know, gun buybacks and other gun ownership encroachments, and they've proven the NRA right. You know, I got a listener. Sometimes he does the show with me. He hasn't done it in a long time because, well, never mind. We won't go into that. Brandon T. He keeps saying, you know, they're not coming for your guns, Brandon. You're just paranoid. He said that about a year ago, and on occasion he'd reiterate it. And I'm thinking, you're a nut. You know what? I apologize to you, Brandon, publicly and openly. You are correct. You were correct more than a year ago. They are coming for your weapons. You got Robert O'Rourke. Some call him Beto. I refuse to call him that. The presidential candidate who sat there and says, that's right. We're coming to take your guns. All of them. And if you own an AR-15 or any other rifle that they don't like, or any other weapon they don't like, you have to sell it back to the government. I got, hey, I'll tell you what there, candidate O'Rourke. You can kiss both sides of my ass, because that's not going to happen. Not now, not ever. Not while I'm breathing, not while I'm on this planet. Not going to happen. Meanwhile, you got Walmart and Kroger starting to buckle. Oh, we don't want you doing any open carries in our stores. You know what? You know something? I want you to think about this in case you missed it a few weeks ago. Yes, there was the mass shooting at Walmart in El Paso, Texas. What is one thing Walmart has in all the stores, at the back of the store in the sporting goods? They have guns. I have yet to hear of one person in El Paso, Texas, one that wasn't carrying that day and didn't shoot him, because apparently no one did or was carrying. But two, if you know how to use firearms and you're being attacked by a knucklehead, an active shooter, why aren't you running your ass back to the gun department? They've got ammunition on the shelf. Grab yourself a favorite weapon and go to work. Think about that. Does that make any sense? Your life is being threatened, and what are you doing? You're hiding. Hiding does not do crap for self-defense in an active shooter situation. You want to know what does work? Engaging the shooter, because he's counting on you to hide. Engage the shooter. Go run back to the department, the sporting goods section, grab a gun. They have a crap load of ammunition there on the shelf, and go after them. Engage. Go to war. Do what you got to do. Take care of business. Now Walmart says they don't want you doing any open carry in their store. All right. What they're saying is that they'd rather, They'll do the deer hunting rifles, but they're not going to do short barrel weapons. And they're not going to sell any ammunition for it either. For them. So you can just. And that's fine. Ask Dick's Sporting Goods how well that did for them. Yeah, that didn't work out well with them. Now, get back to my favorite subject, the attempted coup against a sitting president of the United States, a duly elected member of the United States, I might add. So, Lou Dobbs. I watch Lou Dobbs all the time. I like him. Fox Business Network. Love him there. A couple nights ago, Lou Dobbs asked former acting Attorney General Matthew Whitaker, where are the scope memos? It's been 103 days. Where are the scope memos? Listen for yourself.
Joining us with more on the Justice Department, whether it's posing as transparent or actually working toward that end, blocking the public's view, certainly, of the many unanswered questions about Spygate, former acting U.S. Attorney General Matthew Whitaker. Matt, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me tonight, Lou.
As you may gauge, I'm a little frustrated with a Justice Department that is moving with so little urgency.
So am I.
And I have every reason to believe that that William Barr is the right man at the right job at the right time. There are too many people I respect immensely who believe that for me to, I accept that. What I can't accept is any more of this nonsense. There's nothing transparent. Why would, for example, we not have the scope memos in front of us right now? Why would that not be in front of the American people?
Right. I'm surprised that they weren't part of Mueller's report. He seems to put every other word into that report in the 448 pages right. that we saw. And those scope memos are something that I think would illuminate some people as to what the investigation was and what it wasn't.
We think there were two. There were three.
There were scope memos, and one of the things that
you're
we
not
will learn.
Tell me how many.
One of the things that we will learn in those memos is what crimes were being investigated, and I think to some extent it may or may not help us with the origins of this investigation.
You know what? We need the right as Americans.
Yeah.
To see these documents. We don't need some elitist nonsense attorney sitting in some government office deciding who the hell we are and what the hell they are.
We can agree on one thing that Barr did in the Mueller report should apply to also these scoping memos, and that is to make sure that those that were not implicated or charged with a crime mm-hmm. are not named as targets or subjects of this investigation. Because that's what I fear.
We've done to the president of the United States. Listen,
and I don't think we should have. And I think part two of the Mueller report was not only unnecessary, but I think it sets a dangerous standard that now we vet all of the evidence we find against people that are being investigated that aren't charged. And that is very dangerous.
Let me ask you another question. We now have scope memos, not two, maybe three, maybe more. Who knows how often they were adjusting and innovating in the witch hunt. But we also don't know what happened to the Wiener laptop with all of those emails, all of that evidence. We don't know why the NSA hasn't provided those 33,000 missing Clinton emails and why that isn't available to the American people. This has been a travail without question over the course of 3 years for the American people, for this president, and damn their hide, it's time to act right. like they're public servants instead of a bunch of elitists who are, you know, having a secret handshake. It's obscene what is happening in this country, and people won't even acknowledge that, for crying out loud.
Well, I don't have any problem acknowledging that the American people deserve absolute transparency, especially on how these investigations were started, how the president was added to the investigation, how the special counsel was appointed and why. I think these are all questions that we have to have answers to. Some of this is, you know, you either accept what's been laid out.
I'm not going to accept a damn thing.
This is what Bill Barr's biggest challenge is restoring the trust in the Department of Justice.
You can't do it unless you're fully transparent.
Not just questions
you think should be asked,
right.
but every question every American has got, and put it on the table.
Yeah.
Do we agree?
I completely agree, and this is one of the things that I've been calling for all along.
You know.
And pushing for and asking these same exact questions. When Bill Barr stood in front of the American people and said, I can't get these answers, I'm asking the questions and I can't get the answers, so I'm going to put John Durham to get to the bottom of this, I totally agreed with him because I had the same problem. I couldn't get any answers to my questions as well.
It's time to raise hell and raise the roof. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Lou.
There you go. Now, if you're wondering what the scope memos are, the scope memos were created by Rod Rosensnake that authorized the targeting within the investigation by Robert Mueller. That's what the scope memos, and they named specific targets outlined and approved by Rosensnake that were not charged by Mueller for anything except Flynn Jr., and therefore that's the justification for not releasing them. Now, it might be a valid point. However, the deflection by Whitaker has piqued the suspicious cat's suspicion because the scope memos could be released with non-indicted targets redacted. So who exactly is being protected? The targets are Rod Rosensnake. You make the call. Now, like I said, it's been 103 days. Where are the memos? Now, on May 23rd, 2019, POTUS Trump gave U.S. Attorney General Bill Barr full authority to review and release all the classified material hidden by the DOJ, the FBI, State Department, CIA, the FISA Court, and aggregate intelligence apparatus 103 days ago. So, the Mueller investigation authorized on May 17th, 2017. A Mueller investigation that concluded 6 months ago, yet we are not allowed to know what the authorizing framework was, nor the second DOJ scope memo of August 2nd, 2017, nor the third DOJ scope memo of October 20th, 2017. The released Weissman-Mueller report showed that there are two additional scope memos authorizing specific targeting of the Mueller probe. The first scope memo was August 2nd, and it is an important part of the puzzle that helps explain the corrupt original purpose of the special counsel. The second scope memo was issued by Rod Rosensnake to Mueller on October 20th, 2017. The transparent intent of the second scope memo was to provide Weissman and Mueller with ammunition and authority to investigate specific targets for specific purposes. One of the targets was General Michael Flynn's son, Michael Flynn Jr. Now, what's going to happen here? This is the highlight. I'm looking at a highlighted portion found on page 12 and 13 of the Weissman Report. I'm going to read it to you, and it's going to give you a chance to fully absorb the intent. The corruption is blood boiling. On October 20th, 2017, the acting attorney general confirmed in a memorandum the special counsel's investigative authority as to several individuals and entities. First, as part of a full and thorough investigation of the Russian government's efforts to interfere in the 2016 presidential election, the special counsel was authorized to investigate the pertinent activities of Michael Cohen, Richard Gates, and it's redacted, Roger Stone, and it's redacted. Confirmation of the authorization to investigate such individuals, the memorandum stressed, does not suggest that the special counsel has made a determination that any of them has committed a crime. I know what you're thinking. I'm holding it back. Second, with respect to Michael Cohen, the memorandum recognized the special counsel's ability to investigate leads relate to Cohen's establishment and use of Essential Consultants LLC to receive funds from Russian-backed entities. Third, the memorandum memorialized the special counsel's authority to investigate individuals and entities who were possibly engaged in jointly undertaken activity with existing subjects of the investigation, including Paul Manafort. Finally, the memorandum describes an FBI investigation opened before the special counsel's appointment into allegations that then Attorney General Jeff Sessions made false statements to the United States Senate and confirmed the special counsel's authority to investigate that matter. So we're going to investigate people who have committed no crimes, aren't even believed or alleged to have committed crimes. The special counsel structured the investigation in view of his power and authority to exercise all investigative and prosecutorial functions of any United States attorney. Like a U.S. attorney's office, the special counsel's office considered a range of classified and unclassified information available to the FBI in the course of the office's Russia investigation. And the office structured that work around evidence for possible use in prosecutions of federal crimes, assuming that one or more crimes were identified that warranted prosecution. There was substantial evidence immediately available to the special counsel at the inception of the investigation in May of 2017, because the FBI had by that time already investigated Russian election interference for nearly 10 months. The special counsel's office exercised its judgment regarding what to investigate and did not. For instance, investigate every public report of a contact between the Trump campaign and the Russian-affiliated individuals and entities. The second scope memo allowed Weissman and Mueller to target tangentially related persons and entities, bringing in Mike Cohn, Richard Gates, Roger Stone, and Michael Flynn Jr. Additionally, and strategically, you'll see why, this memo established the authority to pursue jointly undertaken activity. What the hell is that? While Paul Manafort, outlined as an investigative target in the original authorization, the first scope memo, the second scope memo authorizes expansion to his business partner, Richard Gates, and their joint businesses. This memo also permits the investigation of Trump's lawyer, Michael Cohen, and all of his interests, and in ultimate weasel sunlight, Rosenstein, Rosensnake, authorizes an investigation of his boss, Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Before getting to more targets, you have to think about the passage about starting with a lot of investigative material, because the special counsel is picking up a Russian interference investigation that had been ongoing for nearly 10 months. I would also note that the conservative treehouse, all of the illegally extracted FISA 702 query 16 and 17 database search results would be part of this pre-existing investigative file available immediately to Weissman and Mueller. However, in order to use the search query evidence, Weissman and Mueller would need to backfill some alternate justification. That is, they have to find another way to rediscover the pre-existing results. That's a whole different animal. The four identified targets within the original July 2016 investigation, Operation Crossfire Hurricane, were George Papadopoulos, Michael Flynn, Paul Manafort, and Carter Page. So, if we look at the House Intel Report, paragraph U, it says this: the committee's investigation, also reviewing the opening in summer of 2016 of an FBI Enterprise counterintelligence investigation into four Trump campaign associates that we just named. Because of the sensitivity of the matter, the FBI did not notify congressional leadership about this investigation during the FBI's regular counterintelligence briefings. Three of the four original subjects of the FBI investigation have been charged with crimes, and the committee's review of these cases covers the period prior to the appointment of the special counsel in May 2017. So Flynn's under investigation from the outset in mid-2016. The fraudulent FBI counterintelligence operation established by Brennan had Flynn as one of the early targets when Brennan handed the originating electronic communication to FBI Director James Comey. That's a no-no, by the way. The investigation of General Flynn never stopped through 2016 and led to the second investigative issue of his phone call with Russian Ambassador Kislyak in December of 2016. Do I need to go on? Do you want to hear more? Are you angry yet? You should be. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to hold it there. I'm going to hold it there, and then what I'm going to do, I'm going to post a link so you could finish this because it's important. All right. For you preppers out there, we need to talk about survival. How to survive a knife attack. Knife attacks are freaking scary. Knives are available anywhere. They're easy to hide. Quick to put into action. Extremely effective in close quarter. A knife is every bit as lethal as a gun once someone has closed the gap with you And that part is often something you can count on occurring no matter how hard we try to avoid it. Right, preppers? Most traditional martial arts techniques for dealing with a knife attack are less than useless. Flashy, stiff, and ritualized procedures won't cut the mustard before you get cut. Wounds from knives and other stabbing weapons pile up quickly, reducing your ability to fight back while increasing the speed with which you bleed out. All self-defense is high stakes, but defending against a knife-wielding attacker might be the riskiest of all. Despite the common advice to just run away, you probably won't be able to. When the fight is on, especially, escape is usually impossible without stunning or incapacitating your attacker or sacrificing your pound of flesh. What you need to do instead is disable the knife by any means necessary and then reduce your attacker's capability to fight. We're going to talk to you about a few foundational techniques to do just that before getting turned into dog food. Let's talk about the priorities, reality, and common sense. You know, if you are a mind your own business civilian type, and I mean specifically someone who does not run toward danger without a cause, look for trouble, or stack bad men up like sandbags for a living, your only priority is to keep your ass alive so you can go home to your family and the people that depend on you. And of course, keep those same people out of danger when it threatens, right? Ergo, the pinnacle of success when it comes to fighting, especially with lethal force in play, is not to do it. Avoid it. Dodge it. Run from it. Whatever you can do to completely escape from a potentially lethal situation is the ideal, right? Hey, you might not think that's manly or cool, and that's fine, I guess, but maybe you should also like the idea of your family caring for you for an invalid or crying their eyes out at your funeral, or you living the rest of your life in a wheelchair with a colostomy bag. We should always get away if we can. That's true. When it comes to knife attacks, that's not so easy a solution, though it is one we hear trotted out the most often. For example, man, I see a guy coming with a knife, I'm going to run like hell. Good advice, just run away. If he cannot reach you, he cannot hurt you, not like a gun. Indelibly true, and if you can pull it off, you should. But that does not take into the account the reality of the situation, the very real and very scary dynamics of a violent attack, especially one involving a knife in the hands of the assailant. Do you think you'll actually see the bad guy coming? Do you think he'll be across the street or down the block or announce his attention before accosting you? Do you think you'll see the knife unless he wants you to see it in order to gain compliance? Do you think you'll have the speed and acceleration to escape from a knife-wielding attacker who will be statistically younger and faster than you are? Will you even be able to pull away? Plenty of knife users grapple their intended victims. All of these and more represent very real and significant problems for those who will be facing a knife-wielding attacker, and chances are you have not heard any of them mentioned around the rest of the internet unless you are following some pretty switched-on people. Common sense would dictate you run away if you can. That move, chosen at the wrong time and for the wrong phase of the fight, could see you cut up terribly. No, to deal with your in-your-face knife attack, you'll need to start conditioning and developing responses that seem highly counterintuitive to the uninitiated. So what does a typical knife attack look like? It's not like a duel. Does not look like a movie slasher stalking toward you with evil in their eyes. And definitely does not look like a hugely telegraphed overhead strike. The typical knife attack is most often launched from extremely close range as an ambush. The victim does not know the knife is involved in the attack until start getting cut and stabbed. Here are some more traits that many of these attacks have in common all over the world. The attack is launched as an ambush or under false intentions. As with all defensive encounters, the bad guy gets to choose the time and place, but with knife attacks in particular, they will wait until you are distracted by something, boxed in, or are in a transitional space before springing the attack. Alternately, the attacker will get close to you and in such a way that they have cover for being there, or in a way that does not raise your suspicions. The knife stays hidden until the attacker is at contact distance. By the time the attacker draws the knife, it is too late to really see it coming. Contact distance is arm's length away. Way too close for you to have much in the way of a reactionary space to work with. You will not have time to draw a pistol, your own knife, or hardly anything else. If you're lucky or very good, you may have time to react to their draw, but not much else. Chalk this up to another good reason to maintain a gap from all known contacts, if at all possible, though this is impossible if one cares to go out in public. Yes. The gap. The attacker will initiate the attack with their non-knife hand. The attacker's free hand is used alternately to strike or latch onto you. This will both protect their weapon from you, as well as serve as a sort of red herring for your conditioned response. Got it. If you react to an empty hand with a defensive maneuver, the knife has a much higher chance of scoring a severe first hit. After making contact to grab you, the attacker will apply pressure to keep you off balance and keep their blows coming. Knife attacks are extremely brutal. Frankly, an attacker uses a knife when they want to kill you real good, not intimidate you as with a gun. Expect a frenzy of blows with the intent of driving you to the ground for a coup de grace. Their intent is to inflict as many lethal wounds as they can in a short amount of time, which knives excel at. Even among the violent ones on the margins of society, a knife attack will be beyond horrible in its ferocity and murderous intent. Rapid-fire stabs are the M.O., modus operandi, not slashes. It is commonly seen in prison knife attacks and elsewhere where they have been captured on film. A knife-wielding attacker will often stab as quickly as they can along various paths to score as many hits and create as many wounds as they can. Attacks may start high and go low, or start low and go high. This repetitive stabbing is often referred to as a sewing machine motion, or just like a sewing machine. It is not fancy, but nothing fancy is needed to kill with a knife. A knife attack will usually conclude as quickly as it starts. The vast majority of knife attacks will be over in half a minute. Many won't last a quarter minute. That's 45 seconds for you victims of public schools. Some knife attackers will halt their attack early over fear of being caught, especially if you are making a good show of defense. Others will not and will press on as long as they have in order to kill you unless stopped first. In summary, a knife attack will be launched from bad breath distance when you don't see it coming and don't expect it. You will not be able to run without being wounded if you can run at all. You may take several wounds by the time you're even able to react to the attack. The attacker will attack you relentlessly and at speed in a bid to kill you before any resistance can be mustered. So you must have the skills to fight back and defend yourselves. What about martial arts? All right. The various systems that sprang from historically blade-oriented cultures, nothing could be better than that, right? Wrong! 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 The failures of traditional martial arts for knife defense. You know, much of what is taught as standard procedure for knife defense originates from various traditional martial arts systems, especially those that are blade-centric, as with those found in the Philippines. Many there may be considerable merit in many of these systems and individual techniques. As a class, much of it is unsatisfactory for real-world interpersonal violence. Why? It's simple. So much of what is taught for use in a dojo by people engaging in the same system in a dojo, nowhere else, except perhaps a formalized tournament or a competition. Yes, the techniques all appear very efficient and certainly effective when used against a training partner, but on the street and out in the world, your opponent will not be helping you or waiting patiently for you to block his attack, for you to employ your elegant countermove. Your average traditional martial arts defense drill versus a knife looks something like this. Upon a pre-agreed ready signal, one training partner, the attacker will employ a massively telegraphed and comparatively slow overhead stab, equally slow, and wide slash or comically staged thrust. The other partner, the defender, will then employ the prescribed block or parry, at which time the attacker freezes as if affected by some spell while the defender applies counterforce. At the end of the defender's movement, the drill is reset. That's no good for practicing and conditioning yourself for a real steel knife attack. The point. There is so much wrong with this methodology, lest you think I am picking on those who practice traditional martial arts. Please let me know. That is not the case. I am not making an argument against their suitability for real-world lethal force solutions. For starters, a knife-wielding attacker, even a crazed novice, will not telegraph their stroke or thrust to such an extent or do at a measured pace. The knife will be delivered with hateful intent, that is to say, quickly and repeatedly. Additionally, assuming you do block or parry the initial attack, the fight continues. The attacker will be withdrawing the knife for a follow-up slash or stab attempt, not halting, waiting for your move. The final nail in the coffin against the TMA techniques is the fact that the vast majority of them, at least the vast majority of them that are typically taught, never, ever have to employ the technique against a truly resisting opponent. Surely, they may in fact be performed by both parties with speed and some force, but all of the above critiques remain. Your attacker will never be piling in with a sewing machine style attack, tackling you to the ground, or grabbing you in a rude way with their free hand to tie you up and keep their range. A missed block will not be followed by 10 more rapid fire stabs. There will not be a truly physical clash, just a tightly choreographed dance between two consenting parties. So the real test for real world techniques is simple. One, does it work when performed with both parties at full speed? Does it work when performed with both parties at full power? Does it work against a resisting, thinking opponent? That's it. It's a simple affair to set up safe training in a gym or dojo setting and sort this out. Headgear, mouth guards, light gloves, groin protectors, along with safe training blades, will quickly sort the legitimate from the hobby. Yes, it is true. Now, with both parties moving it, near full power at full speed and allowed to do basically anything they want, just like a real fight, you will soon hear all the kinds of excuses coming out of the traditional martial arts camps. None of them matter. They want the fight to be one way, but it is the other way. All I care about and all you should care about is how effective the techniques are. Nothing more, nothing less. That's how it's going to break down. Now, there is no great secret to knife defense that I learned from some forgotten monk on a Himalayan mountainside. The key factor in knife defense is this: you must control the knife and the arm that wields it at all costs. Failure to do so may cost you everything. That's it. Nothing new. I'm sure you're, the difference though between techniques that work and ones that don't is how they go about this. Any technique that would have you going for the attacker's wrist or hand in an attempt to hold the knife away from you or control it is thusly doomed to fail. The physics of it are against you. The attacker will be able to create too much space and too much leverage and rip their hand clear, or at least try to, potentially cutting the hell out of you in the process. This is two-on-one technique. Also does nothing to contain or address their free hand, which will be put to use working you over by producing another weapon. If armed, much the same will be prescribed, the key difference being that your knife will be attacking the attacker's knife arm in an attempt to defame the snake. Disarming the attacker, as it is called in the Filipino systems. While this certainly works better, a failure still results in the same thing. The attacker retains his weapon and has enough of his wits and options about him to keep attacking. A better option might be is to crash into the attacking arm, tie it up to deny its use to the bad guy, and then immediately go to work on the attacker in an attempt to disable him one way or the other. Now I can hear you going, what? Move forward the knife? Are you crazy? I want to get away from it, not move closer to it. Now, while it seems counterintuitive, It really is the only option in close combat that will end the assault. Think about it. If you keep your distance, fending, dodging, parrying the knife every time the attacker thrusts or slashes, how long do you think you can keep that up without getting tagged? I mean, how good are you? Every time you fail, even on some half-assed slash, you are getting cut. Blood is flowing. The mental and physical wounds will start piling up, and then you'll start making mistakes, and then the big stab, the one that kills you, comes. That is assuming, of course, a knife does not come in on a charge. Held low, with one arm trying to grapple you and hold you in place so the knife can give you the old in and out to the guts or kidneys in a prison yard style sewing machine attack. The only possible close-in defense against either is to take the knife out of play, if only temporarily. Sure, you can do that by attempting a disarm, but a more reliable and safer method is to simply secure the arm, holding it to rob it of the ability to do the work on you. Then you go to work in a big way on the guy holding it. All right. Now you probably heard the best defense is a good offense. Well, they're not wrong. So you want to tie up the knife. Are we running out of time here? Oh, I got a few minutes left. How much are? Ooh. Okay. I am going to post this also on the CRN Mumblet site. www.mumblet.com. I like it better than Disgrace Book. One, you can say what you want. Conservatives are not put in the gulag. Your account isn't suspended. You're not given warnings for violations of the community standards in effect at that particular day on that particular time. And I think it's even more functional than Facebook. I like it a lot. And you can earn a few cents, you know, a little bit of money there on Mumblet. That's right. You can earn money on Mumblet. Every time you post something, every time you reply to something, you earn a little, you know, sure it's fractions of cents, but you, at least you're getting something, unlike Facebook, which sells your personal data constantly to anybody that will pay for it. Anyways, my friends, I'm going to post that and some of the other links there on the CRN page on mumblet.com. Mumblit. Mumblet.com. It's free. And I think it's got more functionality and much better than Disgrace Book. And besides, let's be honest. If you're a conservative, you're a prepper, you're a patriot, Facebook doesn't want you there anyways. You're there because your family or friends are there. And they might not leave Facebook. You know what? It's okay. Just because they want to stay there doesn't mean you have to. Leave! It's long overdue anyways. But I like Mumblet.com a lot better. I also like MeWe.com. Not quite. It's probably about the same as Facebook, but I think Mumblet offers more functionality. I really do. Check it out. I think you might like it. Like I said, Facebook doesn't want you anyways. You're a conservative. You're a prepper. You're a patriot. They're just looking for a reason to throw you out and suspend your account. Save them the time. Move on. Let them go. Besides, all they're going to do is take your personal data and make money off it. They don't want you that bad. All right. Don't forget to check out ContraRadioNetwork.podbean.com. You can listen in to the Conservative Underground with Don Lowry, The Prepper Guy with Mark Boyle, all kinds of fun stuff. The Dope Farm Report with Wynn Parkinson, he's also on there. And listen to KYH 540 AM in Utah. If you can listen into it, that's great. I appreciate it. In the meantime, do me a favor. If you like what you see, you like what you hear on the videos, which will be posted on CR at the podbean.com, send me $2 a month. $2 a month. That's what I'm asking. I mean, come on, guys. Even you guys could do this. I'm asking for a cup of coffee for 1 month. $2 a month. I mean, really. All right, until next time, I'm John Jefferson saying thanks for listening. and we will talk to you again next week.